Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The United States is marking the 14th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on Friday with a series of observances to remember that dark day. President Barack Obama, along with his wife and White House staff, observed a public moment of silence Friday morning on the White House lawn. In New York, families of the victims gathered for a tolling of bells and the reading of the names of those killed in the terrorist attack. At the Pentagon, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter and other officials joined in remembrances for the victims, relatives, and Pentagon employees. Also, there was a moment of silence at 10:03 a.m. when one of the planes crashed into a field in Shanksville in western Pennsylvania before reaching its likely target of Washington, D.C. In all, nearly 3,000 people were killed when al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four commercial airplanes in coordinated suicide attacks. A European Union proposal for its 28-member nations to more equitably share the burden of Europe's escalating migrant crisis is meeting resistance, despite its endorsement Friday by the United Nations. At a meeting Friday in Prague, the foreign ministers of Hungary, the Czech Republic, Poland, and Slovakia refused entreaties by their counterparts from wealthier Germany and Luxembourg to accept mandatory quotas in the EU's plan for distributing 160,000 migrants among all member countries. Germany's Frank-Walter Steinmeier called for a fair distribution mechanism for dealing with the additional migrants expected to enter Europe. His country receives more asylum requests than any other European nation and anticipates 800,000 migrants to arrive this year. This is VOA News. A bomb exploded Friday in a camp for people displaced by Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency, killing at least seven people and wounding 20 others. Chris Stein has more on the story from Lagos.
The blast at the Malkohi camp outside of the northeast city of Yola went off about 10:50 a.m. local time. Sani Dati, senior information officer for the National Emergency Management Agency, has details.
It was a bomb planted inside a tent in the camps near a store inside the IDP camps.
Malkohi camp was one of several in the Yola area that housed people fleeing the Islamist Boko Haram insurgency, which has ravaged three northeastern states and forced 2.1 million people to move elsewhere in the country. In April, women and children rescued from the group in the Sambisa Forest, a Boko Haram stronghold, were brought to the camp. President Muhammadu Buhari has vowed to eliminate the extremist group, but Boko Haram has killed more than 700 people since he took office in May. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The Cuban government says it will pardon and release more than 3,500 prisoners to mark Pope Francis' visit to the island this month, the largest amnesty since the 1959 revolution led by Fidel Castro that established communist rule in Cuba. An announcement by the Council of State in Havana Friday did not indicate whether any of those being freed are considered political prisoners by Cuban and international human rights organizations. The decree takes effect and the prisoner should be released within 72 hours, state-run media said. Saudi officials say at least 62 people were killed and 30 others injured when a crane crashed through the roof at the Grand Mosque in the holy city of Mecca. The crash left piles of debris and jagged rubble. Work has been underway to expand the mosque compound. The incident occurred as hundreds of thousands of Muslims gather from all over the world for the annual Hajj pilgrimage, set to begin in Mecca later this month. An Indian court has convicted 12 people in connection with a serial blast that ripped through seven trains within minutes 9 years ago in Mumbai. The rush hour explosions in the packed first-class compartments of evening commuter trains killed at least 188 people, wounding more than 800 others in July 2006. Second river in typhoon-hit northern Japan has burst its banks, stranding dozens more residents, putting more pressure on rescue officials dealing with the region's worst flooding in decades. The Shibui River overwhelmed rice fields and houses early Friday in the largely rural town of Osaki, about 350 kilometers north of Tokyo. Officials say at least 40 people are stranded. Military helicopters and boats rescued dozens of residents overnight Thursday from rooftops in Choso. Officials say at least 25 people are missing there. And all more than 100,000 people in northeast Japan have been ordered to leave because of the storm. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Children's Fund is calling for urgent action by the European Union to fully protect children fleeing conflict in Syria and other war-torn countries. UNICEF says refugee children are particularly vulnerable and open to abuse and exploitation.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up also in the news. A bomb attack today on a Nigerian camp for the displaced. EU foreign ministers are considering a $2 billion trust fund to help African governments improve living conditions at home. And officials in Burundi say the head of the army has survived an assassination attempt in the capital, Bujumbura. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a bomb exploded today in a camp for people displaced by Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency, killing at least 7 people and wounding 20 others. An official says this is the first ever attack on a Nigerian IDP camp. The blast at the Maloki camp outside of the northeast city of Yola went off at about 10:50 a.m. local time. The bomb had been placed inside a tent. Maloki camp is one of several on the Yola area that houses people fleeing Boko Haram, which has ravaged 3 northeastern states and forced 2.1 million people to move elsewhere in the country. Migrants continue to sail in large numbers from Turkey to Greece. Greek authorities say about 3,000 migrants and refugees, mostly from Syria, arrive on the island of Lesbos daily. Meanwhile, police on the Greek mainland say about 4,000 migrants heading to Germany and other northern countries are now blocked at the Macedonian border. Those who reached Hungary are confronted by a government whose prime minister accuses crowds of migrants struggling for food packets of being rebellious. Viktor Orban has held thousands in a detention camp. Human Rights Watch has called conditions in the camp abysmal. Mr. Orban has also threatened to begin arresting disorderly migrants next week. Austria temporarily closed 60 kilometers of its major A4 highway to cars and trucks to enable some of the more than 12,000 migrants traveling on foot from Hungary to safely reach Vienna, the capital of Austria. However, special trains from the Hungarian border have been stopped. Austrian government officials must decide how to manage the massive flows into the country. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel says her country welcomes the migrants to ease a critical skills shortage. A poll in France shows people increasingly in favor of taking the migrants. Last week only, 44% approved. The new poll now shows 53% approval. Interior ministers of the European Union will meet on Monday to decide what to do with about half of the 350,000 migrants and refugees who recently arrived. The EU would also like to help reduce future migration from the Middle East and Africa. EU foreign ministers are considering a $2 billion trust fund to help African governments improve living conditions at home. Alexandre Pollack is a spokesperson for the EU's Humanitarian Aid, Crisis Management and International Cooperation and Development Agency. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold about where the EU funds will go.
This covers the whole of Africa, but clearly the Sahel region has been a strong target because we've got there are very strong needs in supporting what are the grassroots causes of all this refugee crisis. So there are a list of countries, but the issue of Mali show that we need to continue our support there. In the Horn of Africa, you know, the overall situation, I can take the example of Somalia. Obviously, there is an interest to continue to work in this region. And the North of Africa, it includes as well the Maghreb, as you can see. Turkey, Libya, and Egypt. Those countries or group of countries that want to continue to work with the European Union in us helping them to tackle some of the root causes of this refugee crisis.
How long a support would this be?
It can be from project to 6 months, to 1 year, 2 years, depending on the sector you're working on. Here we are talking of a time frame of an instrument that is called the European Development Fund, and that covers the period until 2020. This proposal was announced by the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, in front of the European Parliament, so the 9th of September. And it's a political proposal that then will be submitted to the member states of the European Union. We've got that. And then the aim is to have it start to be operational following a summit that we have between Africa and European Union countries planned in La Valletta at the beginning of November in Malta.
Then the motivation for this trust fund is migration across the Mediterranean from these countries in the last year and a half.
It's partially correct in that the main motivation, this fund was already planned, the fact that we need to continue to invest in development assistance in general, in the fight against extreme poverty, is not news. Of course, the refugee crisis at the moment with so many people dying is a wake-up call to speed up this cooperation and strengthen it in terms of the intensity. And I would add as well that this is a trust fund for Africa, but it was presented as an overall package of measures, and one involved as well, for instance, our humanitarian aid to Syria. The European Union so far has invested more than 4 billion euros in humanitarian aid support to Syria.
Is this a large increase over past years?
It's clearly an increase of our support to these countries. It's an additional, indeed, money and support coming from what we call our reserve. So, yes, this fund did not exist, and now it's existed, and we already put 1.8 billion euros in it, and we expect our member states and others, actors, to chip in as well. Countries such as Spain already confirmed they would do so, so we expect other European countries to bring their money so that we work in the long run, because it's not something that is going to be solved in months to come.
Are you asking the member countries to voluntarily contribute whatever they can?
So it's two things. First, what we put on the table as European Commission is part of the European Union budget that needs to be approved then by all member states in what we call a council. So this proposal will be then presented to a member state. So it will likely be supported by our member state. And then it's their political responsibility to add extra money. But as said, Spain already said so, and we've got very good signal that member states and many of them will continue to give more support to this trust fund so that we can launch it together, this EU-Africa Valletta Summit in November. This trust fund that is really about African and European working hand in hand to tackle the root causes of this refugee crisis.
That was Alexandre Pollack of the EU's International Development Agency in Brussels. He spoke to VOA's David Arnold. The United Nations Children's Fund is calling for urgent action by the European Union to fully protect children fleeing conflict in Syria and other war-torn countries. UNICEF says refugee children are particularly vulnerable and open to abuse and exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund finds children make up one quarter of all asylum seekers in Europe so far this year. In the first 6 months of 2015, it reports 106,000 children sought asylum in the European Union, most from war-torn Syria, followed by Iraq and Afghanistan. Peter Salama, UNICEF's regional director for the Middle East and North Africa, says that after 5 years of conflict in Syria, the war is coming to European shores. Speaking on a telephone from New York, he says it is important to remember why Syrians are fleeing their homeland.
Especially for the children, it's becoming a living hell. We know that millions of people are now living under siege. Water is being deliberately cut off to population centers. Education and health facilities and their personnel are regularly being targeted.
Salama says children are being killed and maimed by aerial bombardment. He says boys as young as 8 are being forcibly recruited as combat soldiers. Girls are being used as sexual slaves or forced into early marriages. He says Syria is moving toward becoming a failed state, and the country's children risk becoming a lost generation. Given this context, he says it is hardly surprising that people are fleeing to salvage a future for themselves and for their families. Salama says it is critical that European countries provide health care and protection services for the refugees. He says their asylum policies must take children's best interests into account.
As well as that, we need to ensure that all along the journey, from the points of origin through the transit countries, and finally to the destination countries, children are protected from exploitation and abuse. We're particularly concerned, for example, about Libya, another crisis-affected country which is an important staging post for trafficking and refugee migration through to Europe.
In the meantime, the UN Refugee Agency welcomes a European Union plan to relocate 160,000 refugees from Greece, Italy, and Hungary to other countries in Europe. But the UNHCR says for the plan to work, reception centers that can quickly register incoming refugees must be set up in the 3 countries of first asylum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A bomb exploded today in a camp for people displaced by Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency, killing at least 7 people and wounding 20 others. And migrants continue to sail in large numbers from Turkey to Greece, with Greek authorities reporting about 3,000 migrants and refugees, mostly from Syria, arriving on the island of Lesbos. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Since the West Africa Ebola outbreak began in late 2013, there have been more than 28,000 cases and more than 11,000 deaths. A new report describes the difficulties, complexities, and disagreements in treating Ebola patients in under what it calls austere conditions. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have been the hardest hit countries in the Ebola outbreak. Their health systems were ill-prepared for an epidemic that size and were quickly overwhelmed. The study in the medical journal BMJ Case Reports follows the case of a 33-year-old West African man. His identity has been withheld for privacy reasons. Despite treatment, his condition steadily worsened, and he died after being under care for 17 days. Dr. Paul Dillon is the lead author of the report. It says when there's no chance of recovery, palliative care, or relieving pain, is a vitally important aspect of care of the patient. It says that a good death is now the expected standard of care in the developed world.
That period at the end of life where we know that death is imminent and that we're doing everything we can to ensure that there's no added suffering that we can't palliate.
Dillon worked in Sierra Leone when he was a medical student. Now the Canadian physician is with the Saskatchewan Medical Association's Rural Relief Program. The study says the Ebola case in question illustrates many of the conflicts and ethical issues that can arise when multiple caregivers are providing care in an austere and unique environment, specifically an Ebola treatment center.
It definitely affected the clinicians not only on a medical level, but also on a personal level.
He says the Ebola patients' care involved a mix of cultures.
We had Cubans, Canadians, British, and then Sierra Leonean nationals. All would have been involved in the care. So we had definitely different cultural aspects as well. Cubans had been there for 6 months, so they had a wealth of clinical knowledge. And then you've got the UK perspective, and you've got the Canadian perspective, and then you also have the Sierra Leoneans, who have that kind of cultural nuance that probably we didn't have as much.
The report says making decisions about the Ebola patient was difficult for a number of reasons. It states the multiplicity of providers and the limited space for discussion caused a large degree of discontent through the group of caregivers. It says many were of the mind that treatment was futile, as was lengthening the pain and suffering the patient was undergoing. The report goes on to say that these clinical thoughts were made doubly difficult through the fact that not only were the clinicians dealing with predicting death, but they were also dealing with a new clinical entity, the course of terminal Ebola, with a dearth of literature to guide their decision-making. While in West Africa, Dr. Dillon worked for Save the Children UK. He says lessons were learned in treating the Ebola patient.
I think the importance of really early communication with everyone and then having set goals and actually having a discussion about how we're going to decide when withdrawal of care and provision of palliative care is going to start. We did have our one clinical lead. Everyone kind of, not necessarily fell in line, but everyone kind of said, okay, this is what we're going to do. And you need to have that one person who is the go-to. Just lots and lots of communication, open communication.
The World Health Organization promises any future Ebola outbreak will see a much faster response than the current epidemic received. And with encouraging research for effective Ebola drugs and a vaccine, officials hope any future outbreak will be quickly contained and ended with a minimum loss of life. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Officials in Burundi say the head of the army has survived an assassination attempt in the capital Bujumbura. A witness and a police source say men in military fatigues fired on General Prime Niyongabo as he traveled in a convoy today. The general is reportedly unharmed. The French news agency reports 7 people were killed in the clash, including 4 bodyguards, 2 attackers, and a female police officer. Security forces have cordoned off the area of the attack. Niyongabo is believed to have helped foil a coup attempt in May against President Pierre Nkurunziza. The president sparked violent street protests with his bid for a third term. More than 180,000 Burundians fled the country to avoid the political violence that followed. Nkurunziza won re-election in July in a vote that the United States and European Union said was neither free nor fair. Critics say his third term violates constitutional term limits and the Arusha Agreement that ended Burundi's civil war. The president's top security chief was killed in a rocket attack last month. VOA's David Arnold spoke to several analysts following developments in Burundi, including the president's defiance of the U.S. and other Western powers.
Analysts say the government of Burundi has now turned eastward for aid and comfort. Political scientist Kara Jones writes in a new article in the U.S. magazine Foreign Policy about how the West lost Burundi. Jones studies Great Lakes regional politics and teaches African affairs at Mary Baldwin College in the U.S. state of Virginia. She says Mr. Nkurunziza turned a deaf ear to the words of Western diplomats in the spring when they demanded open elections. So when he organized his inauguration ahead of schedule, many ambassadors didn't attend.
What it says is that outside influences, for the most part, are quite limited. Many of the great powers and the donors refuse to recognize the standing of Mr. Nkurunziza for the third term. There are many strongly worded statements issued, many threats of economic sanctions and further action being taken.
Local opposition and civil society groups in Bujumbura demonstrated and called his re-election a violation of the nation's constitution. The United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union opposed Mr. Nkurunziza's desire for a third term, citing the Arusha Accords. The Accords, facilitated by the late Nelson Mandela, ended a 12-year civil war with a delicate balance of shared power between Burundi's combatants. Fearing that that balance was threatened by Mr. Nkurunziza's re-election, Western powers vowed economic sanctions for a country that depends heavily on foreign aid. A University of London observer of Central African conflicts, Philip Clark, says Mr. Nkurunziza didn't take the Western diplomat seriously.
Nkurunziza has basically dug his heels in against international pressure for him to leave. Burundi's major donors, the US, the UK and the European Union, have all threatened to withdraw aid. But Nkurunziza, I think, believes that those threats are quite empty. He thinks ultimately that stability for Burundi and for the region requires him to remain in power. He doesn't think ultimately that the donors are brave enough to withdraw aid, so he's sticking to his guns at this stage, and it doesn't look like there'll be any real change in his approach anytime soon.
Clark says the United States, among others, stood firm against his re-election. Regional leaders only asked for a delay in the election. The government made minor concessions in the voting calendar, and the violence continued.
The foreign donors have been extremely disjointed in their approach to Nkurunziza.
Some insisted on the president's departure from politics, and others said he should form a government of unity. So far, Mr. Nkurunziza has done neither. Mr. Nkurunziza gambled when he spurned Western demands because Burundi needs foreign aid and foreign investment. Jones describes Burundi's economy as desperate.
60% of the population is under the age of 18. Joblessness is very, very high, and for the most part, people live on subsistence farming. Burundi needs investment. Burundi needs opportunity.
Like some other African leaders, Mr. Nkurunziza doesn't like the strings that are attached to the foreign aid offered by Western powers. Jones says African leaders often resist the West's painful demands for economic and political reforms.
When a country is receiving more than 50% of its budget from foreign aid, you assume that the donors might have a huge influence on Burundi. And as we've seen in Burundi and to a lesser extent Rwanda, this is actually not the case, that these countries are really trying to establish governments for themselves, trying to find new and innovative ways to solve their funding dilemmas and really make a way for themselves out of the donor aid trap where they get package of reforms and told that they must do these particular reforms.
Like its neighbors, Burundi has some mineral resources such as nickel and cobalt to be exploited. With incentives like that, Clark says President Nkurunziza has calculated that he'll find other donors if he loses the backing of the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union.
He thinks that if he loses the support of the US, the UK and the EU, that may not matter that much because he's building new relationships, particularly with China, Russia and this week Turkey. And he thinks that he can replace the support that he's typically had from Western powers.
Clark says Russia and China would enjoy the symbolic victory of sticking a thumb in the eye of the Western model of peace building and open governance. But beyond the tangible lure of exploiting its mineral resources, Burundi offers Russia, China, and Turkey a major geographic advantage as a gateway to their considerable interests in a much larger country to the north.
Burundi is also very strategically located on the border of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a country that China, Russia, and Turkey also have major economic interests in. So building bases and good relations in Burundi provides them with a launching pad into the much bigger economy of Congo.
The Western powers will watch how Mr. Nkurunziza manages the first months of his third term in office. They'll look for signs that his government is willing to accommodate opposition voices. However, if the president presses his thumb too heavily on the balance of powers crucial to the country's future, sanctions may follow. But other powers could replace the West's pro-democracy influences in that country. This is David Arnold for Voice of America in Washington, D.C.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Yisroelhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa. Your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, I get. This one, I get.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Migrants continue to sail in large numbers from Turkey to Greece. EU foreign ministers are considering a $2 billion trust fund to help African governments improve living conditions at home. And officials in Burundi say the head of the army has survived an assassination attempt in the capital, Bujumbura. Coming up, music from Mali. And in our feature segment, the final installment of our series on a crime-ridden South African township. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sonny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz.
Sonny, I understand you have kudos for a Congolese basketball great.
Yehiz, here's a sunny side of sports salute to the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo, who will receive basketball's biggest individual honor, induction into the Sports Hall of Fame, later Friday evening in the northeastern U.S. city of Springfield, Massachusetts. Let's listen in now to some of Dikembe's Hall of Fame achievements by this announcer in Springfield.
He had an outstanding collegiate career at Georgetown University, where he was a two-time Big East Player of the Year. This eight-time NBA All-Star was one of the premier shot blockers of his or any NBA era, winning the NBA Defensive Player of the Year award a record four times. His work off the court is also stellar, especially in his native Congo, where he opened a hospital which has treated more than 140,000 patients. A true global humanitarian, he's been elected as a player by the North American Committee, Dikembe Mutombo.
Applause for Dikembe Mutombo at the Basketball Hall of Fame. Mutombo says he hopes his induction will help grow the game in Africa and inspire more African children to take up the sport. Dikembe announced his retirement in 2009 after 18 seasons in the National Basketball Association. However, last month, the 49-year-old Mutombo played in the NBA's first-ever game in Africa, an exhibition contest between Team Africa and Team World in Johannesburg, South Africa. Dikembe says it was a great experience to get on the court at Ellis Park.
First, I couldn't believe that one day the game of basketball will be playing in the continent of Africa, especially NBA. I didn't know when, because I waited for this when I was playing. It didn't happen. But when this chance came in that the NBA will play its first game in the continent of Africa, I told myself, I want to be part of that. Not just on the side, but on the court. Even for 1 minute, and I said, if they had to drag me in a wheelchair, I would go and go at least go break the sweat. And I did that. I'm very happy. It was good for me. It was good for Akeem Olajuwon. It was good for the continent. And we felt that we did have an obligation to take part of that. And we're so happy that we participated.
That's the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo, who is being officially inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame Friday evening.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. In pro boxing, unbeaten American star Floyd Mayweather puts his perfect 48-0 record on the line Saturday night when he fights Andre Berto in a welterweight title bout in Las Vegas, Nevada. The money man Mayweather is all business ahead of the fight.
You got fighters that may be faster than me. You got fighters that may hit harder than me. You got fighters that's very athletic. But you don't have no fighter that can make adjustments like me. You don't have fighters that can be on my level mentally. It's never personal for me. It's always business.
Critics say Andre Berto has no business being in the ring with Floyd Mayweather. The 32-year-old Berto, a former WBC and IBF welterweight champion, responds.
When it comes to the critics, they're not in that gym busting their ass and knowing the feeling of being a fighter. They don't know it. They don't know the miles we run. They don't know the punishment that we take in the gym. They don't know the sacrifices that we have to make to become a world champion or just to be able to come on this stage or to be able to make that long ring walk to that ring. It's a small selective few that can do that. And just the fact that I can, of course, you know, hear, you know, whispers of negativity when it comes from people that they couldn't dare to do what we do. So anybody that steps in the ring, I have to respect. But at the end of the day, when it comes to Saturday night, when it comes to fight time, I'm coming for my respect.
Andre Berto looking for respect Saturday night against Floyd Mayweather. I asked our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moweta, about ticket sales for Mayweather Berto.
Sonny, the ticket sales have not been that great. The arena has not sold out. The arena holds 17,000 people. They've sold so far 14,000. So we are left with close to 3,000 tickets not sold. Maybe by fight night, this remaining 3,000 will go. But, you know, a Floyd Mayweather fight where you can still find ticket, it says a lot about the way the public feel about this fight.
What about the pay-per-view sales, Namdi? Does that indicate how the public feels about this fight?
Yes, the pay-per-view sales have been really slow. It's only $75 for high definition. And the numbers are not great. So we come back next week and look at the numbers after the fight. But people are saying, well, you're not going to get 2 million. You're not going to get 1.5. I'm looking at more like 700,000, which is still banking for money man.
The money man, Floyd Mayweather, annually is at the top of the various lists, Namdi, as the richest athlete in the sports world. How much will he make for this Berto fight?
Sonny, for Andre Berto fight Saturday night, Money Mayweather will go home with $38 million. That's crazy paper there, bro. That's what's on the table.
That's guaranteed.
That's guaranteed, yeah. That does not mean that after all is said and done, he can still pick up another extra fight for $10 million. So he's still banking. Regardless how you hate him or you don't like him, he's still making money.
Will this fight fulfill his contract with Showtime, Namdi?
This is the last fight with Showtime. But that does not mean that he will not come back and do one more fight with Showtime. Showtime is open to one more fight with Floyd Mayweather.
Namdi, should Floyd Mayweather beat Andre Berto on Saturday night, that would improve his record to 49 victories without a defeat, tying Rocky Marciano's record, the late great heavyweight. What's your feeling, Namdi? Do you think Floyd will retire after this fight against Berto?
Sonny, this man has been fighting for 19 years. He now is looking at his legacy as about self-preservation, Sonny. He's made so much money, he wants to live with his faculties intact on his own terms, with money in his pocket, Sonny. He's been doing this for 19 years, and he's ready to walk away. He wants to be able to count his money, you know. What's the deal with the 50, you know? He can still come back and say, okay, I want to break that record. There's a brand new arena at MGM Grand. I want to open it. And everybody will say, okay, fight Manny Pacquiao, which is still possible. But for 19 years, he's been doing it, and he's made so much money that he doesn't need to go up and go running or go to the gym anymore.
He's made a lot of money through boxing. He also has his own boxing promotional company, Namdi. What else do you think he might do when he finally does hang up his gloves?
Sonny, after Saturday night, Floyd Mayweather will be going Hollywood. He has 3 movie offers, and he's going to start acting. And you'll see him on the big screen, and that will generate more money. So forget about him going running at 4 a.m. in the morning, broken hands and broken ribs. No, he wants to go Hollywood. And he goes Hollywood, he's coming to our backyard to do his thing, and people will watch because they want to see him.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Mueta, speaking with us once again from Los Angeles, California. Now let's go to Congo Brazzaville for an All-Africa Games update. In a couple of men's basketball results from Friday, Nigeria beat Mali 76-59, and Mozambique edged Ivory Coast 64-62. Our VOA basketball fans will remember Nigeria won its first African title last month in Tunisia to qualify for next year's Olympic men's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. In All-Africa Games women's volleyball results Friday, Egypt defeated the Seychelles 3-0, and Botswana beat Ghana 3-0. Algeria is the defending All-Africa Games champion in women's volleyball. Meanwhile, Egypt and South Africa are at the top of the All-Africa Games medals table with results still coming in on Friday. The Egyptians have an unofficial count of 112 medals, 42 gold, 33 silver, and 37 bronze. South Africa is in second place with 77 medals, 31 gold, 28 silver, and 18 bronze. The Egyptians and the South Africans have dominated the All-Africa Games medals table in recent years. And this 2015 competition, the 50th anniversary of the first All-Africa Games, which also were held in Congo Brazzaville, appears no different. Egypt and South Africa at the top of the medals table. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the final installment of our series of a crime-ridden South African township. And next, we talk to a South Sudanese contestant, a finalist in this year's Miss Africa USA pageant. But first, some music. Here is Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo.
Yambo, yambo, ah, yambo,
Salif Keita of Mali with Yambo. No less an authority than the World Health Organization has branded South Africa the drunkest country on the African continent. Its 2014 research found South Africans who drink liquor consume, on average, more than 27 liters of pure alcohol each annually. This is about 10 liters more than the global average. Safety and security NGOs blame high alcohol use for much of South Africa's violent crime, especially crimes against women and children. Nowhere is this more prevalent than in Deep Sloot, a sprawling, impoverished shackland north of Johannesburg. Darren Taylor reports in the final installment of our series on this crime-ridden South African township.
Men shoot pool inside a smoky tavern in Deep Sloot. The table on which they're playing is cracked, stained and warped. It's supported on one side by a rusty, oil-soaked car wreck. Near the bar's entrance, piles of beer bottles rise from mounds of smoking rubbish. Everywhere on this early Friday evening, people stagger in the streets.
Because everybody wants to get drunk and forget.
Glennis van Halter has been running community projects in Deep Sloot for 20 years, working among the thousands of scrap metal and wood shacks where crime, disease and poverty reign. She says all hell is about to break loose in the township because it's the start of a weekend at the end of the month. The few people here with jobs have received salaries, and residents have been paid their government grants. With money in their pockets, says Van Halter, many only have one thing on their minds.
There's too much alcohol being consumed. There's too much aggression. There's a lot of people who are angry, homeless and jobless and angry, and they get drunk and they don't know what to do with themselves, and there are fights, and it's a really difficult place to go and handle.
A veteran police officer says he's never worked in a place before where so many people drink to get drunk all the time.
That's how they kill each other. Most of the murders that we have, they kill each other in the taverns, they kill each other on the street while they're drunk.
He says most Shabins in Deep Sloot are unlicensed. They sell alcohol illegally to anyone who has money, including children. Tavern manager Gift Munetsi packs beer into a huge freezer. He says so many people in Deep Sloot drink because, as he puts it, booze is much cheaper here than in the suburbs. A sign on Munetsi's wall advertises a 750 milliliter beer for just 10 rand 50, less than a dollar. He charges just 10 rand for a tot of popular brandy. Munetsi acknowledges there's sometimes terrible violence in his bar, like recently when patrons began fighting over a soccer match on TV.
Then after that, we just see two guys standing up, running outside. When they were outside now, the other one stabbed that other one with a screwdriver here, but he died outside.
Community leader Brown Lekekela says people get drunk in Deep Sloot because Shabins are just about the only sources of entertainment in the area. There's just one family park for 600,000 residents. No gyms, no sports fields, no cinemas. Lekekela says he's sick of witnessing the consequences of alcohol abuse in Deep Sloot. He tells of a woman who locked her baby in her shack alone and went out drinking. Neighbours rescued the screaming infant, but not before rats had bitten holes all over her tiny body.
It was awful, like in the feet and in the fingers, in the mouth, where there is, like this, you smell the food here in the feet and mouth, nose, and blood all over the kid.
Lekekela says rapists often target women who drink at the Shabins. Jennifer Mashego, not her real name, says she was attacked after a heavy session at this tavern in Deep Sloot.
Me and some friends were drinking. At about 9 or 10, I was drunk. I felt sick. I wanted to go outside to vomit. Then this man stopped me and said, "You cannot leave. you will not run away from me.
Mashekho says the man followed her, dragged her to a shack, and raped her. Youngsters pour into another bar on the other side of Dipsluit. They're clearly under the influence of liquor. It's 11 a.m. on a Monday morning. Some of the girls wear tight tops and tighter pants. They boast to Lekakela that they've been drinking since Friday and that they're too drunk to go to school today.
Some of them, they're underage, maybe 16, 17. Most of them, they're underage, and mostly they're girls. And they're asking money from the strangers so that they can then buy them beers. But it's normal. I'm used to that kind of life, to see people around like that.
Older men smirk and laugh when the girls join them at the tavern's tables, which are soon brimming with beers. Lekakela says the girls are, of course, expected to give the men something in return for the liquor, sex. And that's how many get HIV and end up pregnant and dropping out of school. By law, bar owners must check IDs and not allow people younger than 18 into their establishments. But Munetsi sighs and says Dipsluit is a place where the law isn't strong, and that even police officers in uniform arrive at his tavern to drink.
If we see a policeman who wants to come and buy a beer, straight away chase him away. No, we can't sell you a beer because...
What does that happen? Do the police come there in the uniform? They want beer?
Some will even know them that this one is a police. They'll be wearing some jackets. Maybe sometimes you can see a badge. If he's on duty, you don't.
Back in the Pudatijaba tavern, couples grope in corners while Bob Marley serenades the darkness. Outside, the cop waits in his patrol car for the radio to crackle into life with reports of more death. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Dipsluit, South Africa.
One of the candidates for Miss Africa USA was a South Sudanese contestant named Iga Mojas. She came in 10th in the recent Miss Africa USA pageant and wants to raise money for orphanages. Ayan Bior reports from Washington.
At 5 feet 9 inches, Maju towered over many at the Miss Africa USA pageant. The 25-year-old, who lives in San Diego in Southern California, says she took part in the Miss Africa USA contest to make her family in Central Equatoria proud and to let people see that South Sudanese women are not only beautiful, but also talented, intelligent, and hardworking.
I believe that being beautiful is not enough, that we also have to have education, just pursue our dreams, and we need to become more than just our beauty. Because in this world, in order for you to survive, you have to have brains.
Maju says she wants to use her talents to help people back home in South Sudan. She says she especially wants to help orphans and people who are suffering from hunger. The UN has said nearly 5 million people in South Sudan are severely food insecure because of the 20-month conflict that formally ended last week when President Salva Kiir signed a peace deal for the country.
So back home, people are actually just dying of the basic essentials that we here in the United States take for granted. So it's kind of hurtful sometimes to watch most of these clips or news articles, and our governments are not doing much to help the situation, to be honest. I wish they would come together and work together and realize the citizens should be put first, not political issues.
Maju says she was inspired to raise money for orphans during a church trip to an orphanage in Tijuana, Mexico, which is a 20-minute drive from where she lives. There, she saw hungry children who were traumatized by the loss of their parents. She immediately felt compelled to help.
That's where my eyes opened up and I realized that I needed to do more for my community and not just be all about myself. And that's when I learned to... That's where my platform came from. I wanted to help mothers and children who needed help.
Maju says one of the lessons she's taken away from the beauty pageant is...
Don't just be beautiful, but also have brains for it. And try to be greater than me, because there's going to be better opportunities for them in the future than what I have now.
Now that Miss Africa USA is behind her, Maju is focusing on the brain side of her life. She is applying for scholarships that will allow her to finish her bachelor's degree and eventually go to law school and work as a lawyer one day. And as she makes her way through school, she fully intends to continue working to improve the lives of those who are less fortunate than she is. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political violence shows no easing in Burundi with the murder of an opposition party spokesman in the capital, Bujumbura. Patrice Gangu of the UPD Zigamibanga party was shot and killed outside his home September 7th, the second top official of the group slain in the turmoil surrounding President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial decision to run for a third term. Other prominent Burundians have been gunned down in recent months as well, with no suspects arrested. 15 years ago, the spirit of the Arusha Agreement transformed Burundi by enshrining the conviction that the government must represent and serve all citizens. Today, Burundi faces a renewed challenge to end violence and achieve lasting stability by coming together in the spirit of Arusha. This isn't the work of one group, but of every person and party. We call on President Nkurunziza and his government, on opposition leaders, and on all the people of Burundi to join now in an open, comprehensive, and representative national dialogue. Nor is it a challenge for Burundi alone. The United States reiterates its support for regional leadership, including Uganda and the East African Community, to convene and mediate a political dialogue and urges them to do so soonest. High-level engagement by the African Union and the United Nations and positive action by all states in the region is critical to bring Burundi back from the brink. We also remain committed to holding accountable human rights violators and abusers and all those who seek to undermine stability in Burundi. President Nkurunziza is well aware of his nation's crisis and has called for security committees to work together with Burundi's security agencies. That is very worrisome, as it includes armed youth militia, including the armed contingent of the Imbonerakure, the ruling party's youth wing. Militia violence and intimidation have profoundly increased tensions and worsened a crisis that has driven almost 200,000 Burundians to take refuge abroad. To prevent further violence, armed Imbonerakure and all militias must be disarmed immediately, with AU oversight. We call on all Burundians to oppose any further acts of unlawful violence and to join together now in the spirit of Arusha to reach consensus and a peaceful path forward for Burundi.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell.
Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.